Welcome, everybody. This is the eighth and final class in the Mises Academy online class, Principles of Economics. This is the spring 2012 edition of the class. And tonight we are talking about inflation, everybody's friend. And it's actually kind of funny that, just so you guys know, in case you're not up to speed on this stuff, the mainstream economists, so it's not just the Keynesians, it's the people calling themselves market monetarists, and lots of people, lots of economists in this crisis now, more and more have been saying what the economy needs, what the world economy needs is a bit higher inflation, and by which they mean price inflation. So let's discuss this from a broad free market perspective, although I should say there are plenty of people in that camp that I just referred to, not the Keynesians, but the so-called market monetarists that would say, hey, we're free market guys too. It's just we think that central banks around the world need to be pumping in more money and so forth. And the problem is that people right now aren't expecting prices to rise quickly enough. So that's a lot more complex than what we're going to go over for tonight's lecture, but I am just sort of relating this to current events that it's funny. I'm here in a principles class about to teach you guys the what I consider to be the grave dangers of government having control of the printing press, and yet a lot of people, a lot of professional economists are right now saying the problem with the world economy is we don't have enough inflation. All right, so let's get into it here. So slide number one, Roman numeral one, the old switcheroo. What I mean here is that, oops, I got to turn on the pen. One second, everybody, sorry. What I mean is that the very term inflation has had two historical meanings. And so by the old switcheroo, I'm saying they switched it on us, and a lot of people don't realize that this switch was made. So the first one, well, I'll go to the next slide here. What it originally meant, so this is the original one, was an expansion in the quantity of money, and some people would say credit as well. So they would say expansion of money and credit. All right, so that's what monetary inflation would be. So it is an inflating, an inflation of how much money is in the economy. Some people might loosely say, oh, it's a inflating the supply of money. I'm going to try in this lecture, I'm not going to be completely anal on this point, but I'm going to try to refrain from talking like that. And the reason, in case you're curious, is just that remember how back when we were doing supply and demand and I was just teaching you guys how to do that stuff, and I was really beating the dead horse about not confusing an increase in the quantity of something versus a change in the actual supply or demand curve. So it's a similar thing here where we just want to be careful. If you start talking about the supply of money, I mean, to me, strictly speaking, that means the whole supply curve. And so what that means is that various prices of money, what quantity of money would the producers of money bring to the market to exchange for other things that, you know, people are bidding to get money with. Just like what I mean by the supply of apples. If I say the supply of apples went up, I don't mean before there were 900 apples and now there are 1,100 apples. Remember, because that's saying the quantity supplied or the equilibrium quantity, or that, you know, that if I'm just talking about a change from one number to another number, that's not supply. That's just a point on the supply curve. So What I'm saying is because I kept beating you guys over the head with that distinction before, a couple weeks ago, now I'm going to try to be careful and not make the same mistake myself when talking about money. And so that's why I'm going to tonight try to, I might slip because it's very habitual to say an increase in the supply of money if what you really are trying to say is like the number of dollar bills in existence went up. If that's what you're trying to say, it's a little bit off to say, oh, that's an increase in the supply of money. Just like if I say the actual number of physical apples went from 900 last week to 1,100 this week, so it was that an increase in the supply of apples, and not really. Or that's a bit clumsy, or that's not a precise way of saying it if you really know what supply means. So it's the same thing here. So anyway, that's not a big deal. I'm not going to be harping on that issue so much, but I'm just explaining to you guys why it might sound awkward where I don't just say the natural thing, which you might be expecting me to talk about increasing the supply of money. Instead, I'm going to say the quantity of money goes up, or the money stock goes up. I might use that term, stock, instead of supply, because stock makes it sound like if you call the store and you say, hey, how many, do you have any TVs in stock? What does that mean? That's saying, like, in the store physically, are there TVs right there? If I show up, can I buy one? Is it there? And so that's also a term I might use tonight to say that an increase in the stock of money. Okay, so originally this term inflation, that's what it meant. So a writer in the 1800s, if he were referring to policies and talked about inflation, he probably meant that. And if somebody said he was against inflation or he was for a deflation, that was probably what he meant, was that he to literally contract the amount of money that was in existence at that point. That's what the deflation would refer to. And as far as credit, that gets really tricky really fast. So I don't want to get too much into that unless you guys in the Q&A ask me questions about it. There is a distinction between money and credit. They're not the same thing. So if I have $1,000 in actual currency on me, that's clearly money. If I say I have a $1,000 credit line with my credit card company, that's not money. It's true, I can go buy stuff. I can go to the store and swipe my credit card and buy stuff, but you just have to be careful how you add that up. All right, it's strictly speaking, my $1,000 credit limit or credit line is not my money. What happens is when I go and buy something with the credit card company gives money to the store. And then the credit card company just says to me, okay, Bob, you owe us, whatever, $800 for that purchase you just made. All right, so it's not that my credit was the money that then bought stuff from the store, that the store took my credit. That's not what happened. When I have a credit card and swipe it, it's the credit card basically pays them, transfers money from their bank account to the store's bank account, and then there's a credit transaction between me and the credit card company. Or if you want to think of it this way, they almost instantaneously and electronically loan me their money, and then I use the money and hand it over to the store, if that helps you think it through in a logical sequence. Okay, so money and credit are not the same thing, and I'm just saying historically, this term inflation, some writers might have meant more narrowly the actual money, and then other ones might have meant a broader notion. But the point in either case is they were not talking about prices. When they talked about inflation or deflation, they meant, in the context of the United States, something that was in terms of dollars floating around. And how many of those things were there? One last thing on this slide before I move on. Things get really complicated with what's called fractional reserve banking. So I'll just write that term out. fractional reserve banking. So if you're a fan of Austrian economics and you start reading on Mises.org and you start delving into Murray Rothbard and Guido Hulsman and stuff like that, and Joe Salerno when it comes to money and banking, you're going to hit this issue pretty quickly. So that's why I'm just bringing it up. For our purposes tonight, and for this principal level class, and you're just going through lessons of the unconscious, it's probably okay if you want to just think about a printing press, just like this picture I have up here with the government literally printing up $100 bills or $10 bills or what have you when you want to think about monetary inflation. But in the real world, most of the monetary inflation historically has come through the private commercial banks. And so again, this is going to get way more complicated than what we need to talk about tonight, so I'm just going to mention it, but I just want you to understand this, that there are different definitions of what constitutes the stock of money. So if somebody says, hey, how much money is there right now in existence, it's not a simple answer. You have to come back and say, well, what are you including in the definition of money? And so, like if you just mean actual currency, well, then that's one number. But a lot of times economists will have broader and broader definitions. And one of the things they'll include is to say, well, your checking account balance is with a commercial bank. That should count as money. So if you think of me as an individual, let's say I have $1,000 in actual currency, you know, green pieces of paper in my wallet, and then I go and deposit 200 of it at my bank. And so now if somebody says, okay, well, how much money do you have now, Bob? Originally I had 1,000 in the form of the currency, and now what do I have? Well, a lot of economists would say it's quite reasonable to say I still have $1,000 in money in my possession. It's just the form of it changed. Now I have 800 in actual currency, green pieces of paper, and I have 200 in my bank checking account that's immediately accessible to me. I can write a check on it, or I can swipe my debit card, or I can go to an ATM and put my card in and then get the 200 in cash out. Okay, so a lot of economists will say that even a fairly narrow definition of what constitutes the stock of money should include people's checking account balances. So if banks merely took your money and put it in the vault and kept track of how much you put in there, and that's all they did with it, then that wouldn't change anything. Whether you put your money in the bank or whether you kept it in your wallet or your purse, the total stock of money in existence would be the same number. All right, so if there were $1 trillion in existence in terms of green pieces of paper, and then the public deposited $200 billion into various checking accounts, and then you said, how much money does the public hold? It would still be $1 trillion. It's just that instead of it being $1 trillion in actual currency, it would be $800 billion in currency and $200 billion in their checking accounts that were all sitting in the bank vaults. Okay. The problem is this thing called fractional reserve banking. In practice, the commercial banks don't just take your money, put it all in the vault, and let it sit there. What they end up doing is they lend out most of it under normal circumstances to somebody else. So you only have, let's say, 10% of your actual, you know, the money that you, the actual currency that you deposited, they might only keep 10% of that in the vault, and they'll lend out the other 90%. So what that means, if you think it through, is that the commercial banks now actually can increase the total quantity of money or the stock of money. Because to go back to that original scenario, I said, suppose the public starts out with $1 trillion in green pieces of paper in their wallets and their purses. And we say, how much money is there in existence? The answer is $1 trillion. Now the public takes $200 billion of that and they deposit it in the commercial banks. And then the commercial banks turn around and they lend out $180 billion of it. So somebody wants to buy a house, and they say, oh, here you go, here's $200,000, and they give him $200,000 in actual cash. And somebody else, you know, is expanding his business and wants to buy a forklift, and they say, how much is that? Oh, it's $60,000. Okay, here you go. Here's $60,000 in cash that we just took out of the vault. There you go. Now, you owe us. I mean, they're not just giving out money. The people owe them. They're signing contracts saying we're going to pay you back at this interest rate and whatever, but that's just a, you know, a side issue, just saying this person now owes the bank money in the future. But in terms of now you say, okay, once the bank's lent out $180 billion of that $200 billion, right, they lent out 90% of it, they only retained 10% or $20 billion in the vault, and the other $180 billion they lent out to a bunch of other people. Now you say, okay, at this point, after the public originally deposited $200 billion in the commercial banks and the banks lent it all out, boom, 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 everything settles down. Now how much money is there in existence in this society? And you might be tempted to say, oh, it's got to be $1 trillion. It's just they're moving money around. Originally, if there was $1 trillion in terms of green pieces of paper, just moving them around is not going to change the total, right? But it actually will if you count checking account balances as part of the stock of money. And there's fractional reserve banking, because those two things put together mean that when the public deposits money, the bank effectively creates new money by lending some of it out. All right, so in the numbers that we've been working with here, what ends up happening is the bank effectively created another $180 billion, the banking system as a whole, when everything settles down. And so now you'd say in the new equilibrium, there's $1,180,000,000,000 in existence at that moment. And so the commercial banking system effectively created $180 billion. And so when you hear people say stuff like, oh yeah, the banking system is all screwy right now, they can just create money out of thin air by lending it, that's what they have in mind. And the people saying that, they probably don't understand all the little fine details of it because it gets really complicated. But basically that statement is correct, that the commercial banking system can create money out of thin air the way the rules work right now. And so a lot of people, including me, think that's kind of weird and it leads to problems. But anyway, that's, I actually spent more time on that than I wanted to, but I at least wanted to make you guys aware of that when we talk about monetary inflation here. For our purposes tonight, if it helps you, just think about somebody running a printing press and creating more green $100 bills, or if you're in Europe, you know, more bills, more euros, paper euros, that's fine. The stuff we're going to talk about tonight, that's perfectly fine, but just keep in mind, in the real world, the quantity of money can expand or contract based on commercial bank lending, and then the public, if they want to pull money out of the banks, then that process I just talked about goes in reverse, and so that can actually shrink the quantity of money if the public gets scared and pulls all their money out of the banks. So it's not just moving the same dollar bills around or the same euros around. The total number of dollars or euros can expand or contract based on how much of it is on deposit with the banks. Okay, price inflation is the newer meaning. So nowadays, now, most people, when they say inflation, they mean that prices are going up. So if people say, oh, what are inflation expectations? They mean, what do people expect will happen to the prices of typical consumer goods, usually? And then they have all sorts of different indices and things like, oh, consumer price index and the core consumer price index, which has energy and food taken out, or they'll have a wage index, which just looks at salaries and wages, or they'll have a commodity price index. But the point is, all those different indices, what they're doing is they're looking at a certain group of prices, and they're looking at over time, are those prices going up or down? And then if they go up, that's what they're calling inflation. And if the prices go down, that's what they're calling deflation. So that's different from talking about the quantity of money. So here, the new meaning, people are talking about prices. So who cares about the terminology? What's the big deal? Why am I calling it the old switcheroo? Well, and this picture, in case you don't understand the reference, is to the Wizard of Oz, and this is the famous part where, you know, he's got the smoke going and everything, and then Dorothy walks around and says, wait a minute, there's just this guy behind the curtain, and he says, pay no attention to the man behind the curtain, right? So the point is, with this inflation stuff, that it's hard to figure out why prices rise if we don't look at monetary inflation. Okay, so what I mean is, the reason I'm cynical of this change in terminology is that, to me, I think it reflects the fact that the people generating inflation want to cover their tracks. So back when inflation, the very term, meant an increase in the quantity of money, well, that put the blame on the people who control the stock of money. So the government, in terms of printing the paper dollar bills, and the commercial banking sector, if you're pretty technical and you understand how fractional reserve banking works. But so there, when you're talking about, when people are arguing over inflation or deflation, whatever your view is, it's clear who's responsible for the trend you're talking about. If you're saying, hey, we've had too much inflation, so who's to blame for that? Well, what institution runs the printing press? The government in modern times. And, or, you know, you could talk about the commercial banking sector if you're sophisticated, and then you'd say, well, which institution sets the rules governing what the banks can do? Well, that's also the government or the central bank, right? So whatever your views were of what proper policy should be regarding inflation or deflation, you knew where to look and where to lay the blame. But now, over the decades, and in terms of when did this switch occur, I'm not sure. I think by the 1950s, using the term inflation to mean rising prices was probably fairly common. And certainly by the 70s, it was common, because people complain about the inflation of the 70s and talk about stagflation, and what they mean is price increases. Okay, so, but I don't have a good feel to tell you exactly when the switch occurred. It could have been much earlier. I'm not confident on that. But clearly the switch did occur, and I think one of the reasons the government, with its ability to influence the discussion and set the tone of the debate and so on, I think they actively encourage that, because when inflation now refers to rising prices, well, you could blame all sorts of people. And that's exactly what happened during the 1970s, when prices were rising. So what happened? In 1971, Richard Nixon took the dollar off of the gold standard. Okay, so people would say, well, he closed the gold window. So what that meant is, up through 1971, the U.S. government had promised to, at least for other central banks around the world, they could redeem their dollars for gold at the rate of $35 for an ounce. So other central banks, they turned in $35 in terms of green pieces of paper, the U.S. government was obligated to give them an ounce of gold. So what did that do? That tied the hands of the government, the U.S. government. They couldn't inflate as much in terms of inflating the money stock. They couldn't just run the printing press like crazy to pay for the Vietnam War and LBJ's so-called war on poverty. They couldn't just run the printing press as recklessly as they otherwise would have, because if there's too many dollars floating around, then too many people are going to go to the U.S. government and turn them in and say, give me an ounce of gold. Right? And so since the U.S. government was on the hook for that promise under what was called the Bretton Woods Agreement, it tied their hands. They couldn't inflate as much as they wanted to. And so eventually the pressure built up, and in 1971, Nixon said, ah, forget it. We can't keep up with this. We want to keep spending. Right? That was the issue, that they were inflating too much. Too many people were trying to turn in their dollars for gold. They were going to run out of gold if this trend kept up. And so they had two choices. One is they could cut their spending, and so they wouldn't have to inflate as much, or they could go off the gold standard and say, actually, no, we changed our mind. We're not going to give you gold for dollars anymore. And Nixon chose the second option. So after he did that, then they started running the printing press like crazy, because now, hey, sky's the limit. And lo and behold, if you look at a chart of consumer prices in the United States, it's rising throughout the 20th century, but at a very gentle pace, and then boom, in the early 70s, there's a kink in the chart, and it starts rising much more quickly. And for those of you familiar with U.S. history, you probably know that by the end of the 70s, price inflation got to be really serious. So what I'm saying is, from my perspective, it's crystal clear what happened, and it's obvious, and people were predicting it at the time, people like Ron Paul and others, that if you unshackle the government and allow them to start printing money like crazy, don't be surprised when prices start rising much more quickly than they used to. But my point is, the public didn't make that connection, because when it comes to rising prices, if that's what the term inflation means, and what we're trying to diagnose is, oh man, why are prices rising so quickly? You have to be somewhat of a, you have to know, have some knowledge of economics to understand, oh, it probably has to do with Nixon taking the dollar off the gold standard, and now they're printing more dollars. That's kind of an abstract argument. It's a lot easier to just say, oh, it's those Arab countries that sell us oil, and they restricted their output, and so that's why oil prices are high, and that's why the gasoline prices are high. And, oh, gee, wages keep going up. Well, it's because of those greedy unions. And, oh, man, when I go to this store, paper towels keep getting more and more expensive. Well, it's because of those greedy capitalist pigs trying to rip me off, right? So whatever group of people you don't like, it's easy to blame them when there's a period of rapidly rising price increases. Because obviously, when you say, why did gasoline get more expensive? I mean, the last person in that list of events or causal sequence is the guy at the gas station who decides what to charge. So really what happens is, because they print more dollars, eventually people bid up the price of crude oil, and then that gets transmitted through the pricing chain, and eventually the retailer, the person who just buys gasoline from refineries and has it shipped to his little store, and then he fills up the tanks underground and then sells it to motorists, that person, I mean, his margins are what they are, and if the wholesale price to him goes up, well, he's got to raise his price or he's going to go out of business. But in terms of the average Joe trying to figure out how come gasoline is so much more expensive today than it was a year ago, he's going to get mad at that guy. And maybe if he can think a little bit ahead, he's going to say, oh, it's the people selling crude oil. It's those sheiks in Saudi Arabia. I don't trust those guys. They're out to get us. And you never wonder, well, weren't the sheiks in Saudi Arabia out to get us in 1964 too? Like, what? Why did they wait till the 70s all of a sudden to raise their prices and get a bunch more money from Americans, right? So anyway, my point is, this terminological shift, one of the reasons that it's significant is that when you've taken your eye off of the ultimate cause of all this, and you're just looking at the consequences, now it's a lot harder to battle it, right? So it's kind of like, imagine in humanity's fight to cure cancer, what if we stopped calling it cancer? What if we started calling it headaches or something? You know, if you're talking about brain tumors. Or what if you just start calling it pain or something? You see what I'm saying? That, because we all know what the word cancer, to make the analogy better, it would mean, what if the very word cancer now didn't mean a malignant tumor, or didn't mean a tumor or something, cancerous cells? What if the very word cancer we redefined to mean the pain you experience in your head when you have a tumor? That would be weird, and it would make it harder for people to even know what you were talking about. All right, whereas now we refer to the thing that we're pretty sure causes. I mean, suppose it's possible we're wrong, and the people who have headaches, who have brain tumors, the two are unrelated. But you get what I'm saying, I hope. So the same thing with inflation. So what happens is you end up with this absurdity where the Federal Reserve promises to be vigilant to combat price inflation, and the Fed looking out for us. And Rothbard really just blows that stuff up in a lot of his writings. It's the absurdity of that idea where you have Federal Reserve officials, or if you're in another country, whatever your country's central bankers are called, but you have these officials who are overseeing the creation of new money day in and day out, and prices are rising, and they're saying, we're here to make sure to protect you, the consumer, from too rapid price increases. And meanwhile, they're sitting on a bunch of printing presses that are cranking out new money. That's crazy. If they wanted to stop rising prices, they would stop creating new money. Okay, the price of money. So here's the definition. The price of money is its purchasing power, meaning how many goods and services someone would need to offer in order to buy a unit of money. So I've got the word price and the word buy there in quotation marks because I want to make sure you recognize that it's a little bit weird when it comes to money. All right, so if we were just talking about apples, then this would be straightforward. The price of an apple means how much money would someone need to give up in order to buy a unit of apples. Right? So you say, oh, the price of apples is $2 a pound. What does that mean? It means, if you want to go get a pound of apples, you have to give up $2. That's what it means. So now if we're going to say, what's the price of money? Well, now we're in a bit of a problem here, or we have a bit of a problem, because from one perspective, you could say, well, the price of a dollar bill is a dollar bill. Okay, but obviously that's true. If I went out into the marketplace with a $10 bill and said, hey, how much would you pay me for this? And I auctioned it off, I'd probably get $10 for it, or maybe I'd get $9.99 or something, because people wouldn't want to waste their time auctioning on something that they didn't make a gain. But you get the point that it doesn't really help us much to define the price of money in terms of money, because that's just sort of like a tautology. All right. What we do as economists is we say, okay, money is the one thing where it would be inappropriate to quote its price in terms of money. Because really what happens is, in a typical market economy with a developed monetary commodity, we, in a typical transaction, money is on one side of the transaction. So just about everything that's bought and sold in a market economy is done against money. Right? So there's really not too many cases of actual barter going on. And even if you do barter, usually you're thinking of it in terms of money. You know what I mean? So like if two people are trading things and somebody's like, I have this baseball card and I'll give you these ones for it. I mean, people might be stopping and thinking in terms of, well, what are the monetary equivalents of this? Is this a good move or not? And especially other types of things. I can't think of a great example off the top of my head, but if people are exchanging items that aren't money for each other, they might be reasoning in terms of, well, if I went out and sold this, how many dollar bills would I get for it, and how many would he get? And then if we traded it in terms of money, so since we don't have money right here, why don't we just trade with the same ratios as their money prices would do? And so people might do that. So my point is, when we reckon the market value of things, what we're thinking of is, if I were to go into the marketplace and trade this thing for dollars or for euros or yen, whatever country you're in, how many units of money would I get for this thing? And that's what this thing's price is. So because you can say that for anything, money is like the common denominator of something's market value. And so that's what allows us to compare all sorts of different things, is to say, oh, if this thing is $10 and that thing over there is $20, what does that mean? Well, it just means this thing could fetch 10 units of money and that could fetch 20 units of money. It doesn't mean much more than that, but that's an important thing to know in terms of economics. So with money, though, when we say what's the price of money, it's the inverse of that. That what we mean to say what's the price of a dollar bill means if somebody else wanted to buy a dollar bill from you, how much stuff would they have to offer? Right? Because think of it the other way. To say the price of a car is $2,000, a used car, what does that mean? It means if I wanted to go get that car from the owner, I would have to offer him 2,000 units of money. So now I'm going the other way and I say, what's the price of $2,000? You say, oh, it's one used car. Because the owner of the car, if he wants to convince the owner of the $2,000 in money to give those dollars over to him, he says, hey, I'll give you this used car for it. Right? So it's just looking at the same transaction, but from the other person's point of view. And so just normally when you think of a buyer and seller, you just flip all those roles. And so instead of imagining it as the, instead of thinking of it as somebody going into the store and he's the customer and he wants to buy something so he pays with money, think of it the other way around. Think of it as the store owner is the customer and wants to buy money from his clients by offering them goods and services. Right? So it's a little bit awkward when you first try to think of it like that, but then if you do, everything else falls into place. So the price of money in that respect then would be its purchasing power, meaning how many units of various goods and services do you have to give up to get it. So if I say a gumball has a price of 25 cents, and then I say, what's the price of $1? I say, oh, it's four gumballs. All right, because if I have to give up a quarter, for foreign listeners, a quarter is 1/4 of a dollar. It's $0.25. So if I have to give up a quarter, so a quarter is a coin. It's a fraction of a dollar. So if I have to give up a quarter to get one gumball, and then I'd say, what's the price of $1 bill? It's four gumballs. So it's just the inverse. Right, you're just flipping the numerator and the denominator. Okay. Next slide. So now the price of money is set by supply and demand. So you can, if you want, you can have a price there, and then you can talk about the demand for money and the supply of money, and you can talk about the equilibrium quantity of money and the equilibrium price if you want. But the problem is to interpret what these things mean in the context of money gets a little bit weird. And that's what I was saying before. So what I'm trying to say is, you could do this if you wanted to. So don't interpret my remarks earlier when I was saying I'm going to be careful and try not to talk about the supply of money going up. By saying that, I didn't mean supply and demand don't work when it comes to money. No, they do. It's just things are a little bit weird. And so so one thing that's kind of weird is over here when we're talking about the price of money. Again, it means the purchasing power. And so if the price of money goes up, what that actually means is that prices go down. Right? So if the price of money goes up, then the prices of everything else quoted in money, So prices of all else go down. Right, so if money becomes more valuable, the prices of things in the economy go down. Right, let me just say that one more time. If the price of money goes up, what does that mean? It means the money, a unit of money, is now more valuable compared to other stuff. And so the way the way that manifests itself, the way you observe that, is to see the prices of things quoted in money actually go down. They get cheaper. So your money goes farther. If you have a $100 bill and I say, oh, the purchasing power of money went up, or the price of money went up, now that means you're holding something that's more valuable because its price went up. Just like if you had a car and its price went up, you would have something that had more market value, right? Before you could have gotten $2,000 for it, now you can get $4,000 for it. That's what it means to say its price went up when you're talking about regular goods and services. So with money, if I'm holding a $100 bill and now you tell me its price has gone up, or its value, its market value has gone up, that means I'm in a better position now holding this thing than I was before. So what that means is, oh, I can now buy more stuff with it than I could before. So how is that possible? I still have $100. Well, the way that's possible is if prices of other things quoted in dollars now go down. So if something that used to cost $100 now only costs $50, before I could only buy one of that thing, but now I can buy two. Okay, so with money, when it becomes more valuable, if its price goes up, that means the prices of everything else go down. And the other way around, if the money becomes less valuable, then its price goes down, but that means the prices of everything else quoted in money go up. Okay, so if you think it through carefully, it makes sense, but it's just you might get tripped up because you might have a tendency to say, oh, if the price of money goes up, then prices are going up, but it's the other way around. So if money becomes more valuable, prices go down, and that shows how one unit of money is more powerful than it used to be. Whereas the other way around, if money becomes less valuable, one unit of money is now worth less in the market than it used to be. That means you can't get as much for a dollar or for a euro as you used to be able to. And what the way that appears to you is that you have the same amount of dollar bills or euros that you had yesterday, but now prices are higher. So now you feel poorer. But that money isn't going as far in the marketplace as it used to. So as far as this diagram, let me clean some of this up here. No, that's taking too long. Let me just redo it. So I said price is a little bit problematic, but if you think through carefully, just realize that it's purchasing power. It's a purchasing power. Just keep that in mind when we're talking about the price of money. And the other issue is the demand and supply for money are kind of hard to think through. And so at this level of a course, let's not get into it. Okay, what you could do if you went back and if you're thinking about a totally free market economy where the money is gold, let's say, well, then you could straightforwardly talk about the market for gold, and you draw supply and demand curves, and you would find as the price of gold went up, meaning if gold's purchasing power went up, that the prices of everything else in terms of ounces of gold went down, then the quantity supplied would go up because the supply curve would be upward sloping. And how could the supply curve go, or how could the quantity supplied go up? Well, the gold miners would go dig more, right? So if you're in a world where the money is gold itself, and prices are quoted in terms of weights of gold, so like on a sticker, you go to the car dealership and the sticker doesn't say dollars, it doesn't say euros or yen. The sticker actually says 3 ounces, meaning how many ounces of gold do I have to give the owner to get this car? And that's what prices are quoted in. In that kind of world, you could have a supply and demand curve for gold, and the supply curve would be upward sloping, saying that as the purchasing power of gold goes up, the gold miners dig up more gold, and they bring more gold to the surface. And so there's more gold coming onto the marketplace every period. Just like if the price of cars went up, the producers of cars would bring more cars to market. So in a free market economy, private individuals and businesses produce the money. It's kind of neat if you've never thought about that, but that historically it happened, and certainly theoretically there's no reason to doubt that it happens. You don't need the government to be doing it. And if you thought it through in that free market setting, there's no real problem with the strong supply and demand curves, just so long as you get the thing about the purchasing power and you realize that it's the inverse. But once you get that adjustment, it's fine. Nowadays, since governments typically set the quantity of money, at least if we're talking about the pieces of paper, it's a little bit harder to think through what does the supply curve even mean in that context. So a lot of times what they'll do is they'll just draw a vertical line. And we'll just say this is the original supply curve, meaning, you know, that's what it is. The government just sets it at $1 trillion, end of story. That's how much money there is right now. Doesn't matter what prices are because, boom, that's set. So that's why it's a vertical line. And now if we say what would happen if the government increased that? So let's say they increase it to $3 trillion. So now, before there were $1 trillion worth of money in existence, green pieces of paper floating around, you added them all up, and it would add up to $1 trillion, and now they tripled it. Now there's so many more $100 bills and stuff floating around because they just physically printed them up, and now there's $3 trillion of them, and that's the new supply. So supply increased, and since it's vertical and you've got the demand there, and here's what happened. And you say, okay, so what happened to the equilibrium price of money? Well, originally it was here, and now it drops down to there. So it went down. So if the price of the money goes down, that means the prices of goods and services all went up, because now we're saying a given dollar bill doesn't get as much stuff. So I've had to walk you through this complex graphical analysis to tell you the punchline, which is the obvious thing, that if the government runs the printing press and prints up a bunch of $100 bills, guess what? The prices of things in the community in terms of the price tag and how many dollars are written on it, those tend to go up. Other things equal. The government runs more, the printing press more, prints more $100 bills, the prices of goods in the marketplace tend to go up. Isn't that amazing? Look at the power of graphical analysis. Okay, so what I'm really just trying to get you to see here is you could do that stuff with supply and demand, but it's a little bit tricky, and it's probably, for our purposes, you probably don't gain much by thinking of it like that. I'm just showing you here. You could do that if you wanted to, and if you go on in economics, then you will have to do it like this because you start introducing stuff and it gets complicated. But for our purposes, I just want you to know the basics, that other things equal, you increase how many dollars there are, dollar prices are going to go up, or an individual dollar now gets weaker. And so when we're trying to understand historically, why is it that prices keep going up and up and up? The sort of humorous anecdotes about talking to your grandpa and him saying, oh, back in my day, you go to McDonald's and a hamburger only cost a quarter. And now I can't believe how much they charge. And back in my day, you go to the movie theater and give them $2 and you stay all day. Well, why is that the case? How come it seems to be that every generation can't believe how expensive stuff is, and they look back fondly at their childhood when things were cheaper. Well, a lot of it is simply because there are more dollars that have been created, more euros or whatever. And who's responsible for that? Ultimately, it's the government. Okay. Having said that, this next slide, I'm warning you, don't focus just on the supply. And so what this chart is, and I went through this more carefully in the textbook, but this chart is taken from the St. Louis Fed, which is called Fred, is their nickname. And this is, there's actually a lot of good stuff here. Let me just type that into the thing for those of you who are tuned in live here. So it's the St. Louis, oops, can't spell, St. Louis Federal Reserve website, and it's called FRED, and that's, it's for economic research. So if you go, if you just Google St. Louis Fed and then FRED, it'll probably be the top hit. And anyway, that's where you'll probably recognize it if you get there and you see a lot of economics bloggers, a lot of times in my Mises.org articles, when I post stuff showing the M1 or M2, which are various measures of the quantity of money, or if I post something on the excess reserves in the banking system, that kind of stuff, a lot of those graphs are generated by this Fred website. That's why a lot of people use it, is because not only does it have a lot of information, but it has a very convenient automatic graphing capability, so you can crank out pretty looking graphs fairly easily and everybody can tell what it is. And so there's no, because if you do something in your Excel graphing thing and then you post it on a blog article or something and you have an Excel graph, it's not as trustworthy because people don't know where to get that number, you know. But if you do it with the Fred automatic thing, then you at least know that the numbers are probably official numbers. Doesn't mean they're right, because maybe the official numbers are wrong, but you know, okay, this person probably didn't just make this stuff up, whereas if somebody puts up an Excel graph, you have to worry, what if the person screwed it up, or what if the person just made up numbers? Okay, so what is this thing showing? The lighter line, the one that's on the bottom, is the consumer price index, CPI. And the top line, the heavier one, is the M1 stock of money aggregate. And so M1 measures the actual currency in the hands of the public, the green pieces of the paper, and it also measures checking account balances. So it's a narrow measure of the quantity of money. There are broader ones that people use, M2, M3, but M1 is fairly narrow. So what's my point here? If you look at, when does this start? From 1960 through about 1983 or so, those two things track each other fairly closely. And they're indexed here. So if you're wondering what the units are, it's just saying if you set, I think I said, yeah, the 1960 value. So I set the 1960 value at 100 for each of them. So obviously the consumer price index is in one type of unit and the M1 stock of money is another type of unit, but the point is for this graph, I set those equal to 100 at the start and then I just track them over time. And so you can see how they moved fairly closely, so that from 1960 up and through 1983 or so, a given percentage increase in the quantity of money tended to yield about the same percentage increase in consumer prices. And that's the way you know that, is because those two lines track each other fairly closely. But then there was a big divergence from about 1983 onward. And you can see that what happened is the quantity of money increased much more quickly than consumer prices. So they were both increasing, but the point is the quantity of money by this top heavier black line, when all is said and done at the end of this period in 2010, M1 is about 12 times higher than it was in 1960, right? Because that index went up to about 1,200 and it started at 100. So what that means is it went up by about a factor of 12 over this 50-year stretch, whereas the price index only went up, just an eyeball, and looks like around 750, so about 7.5 times. So what that means is, to say in other words, from 1960 to 2010, or maybe it goes to 2011, I'm not sure when this cutoff is, the money stock increased by about a factor of 12, but consumer prices only increased by about a factor of 7.5. So what I'm saying here is, it's, even though it's true to say other things equal, when you increase the stock of money, the purchasing power of money goes down, meaning prices go up, don't think that it's a mechanical relationship and that, oh, a 10% increase in the stock of money means a 10% increase in prices. That's not necessarily true. And so in terms of your supply and demand framework, what happens? Well, the demand must have gone up too. So we can even do that. Let me go back here. So what happens? I'm going to keep using the same graph. You saw how if the supply increased and the demand stayed the same, well, then prices drop. But what if I told you at the same time that supply increased, what if the demand for money increased also? So D1 is the original one, and now D2 is this new one. Oops, I did that too much. I didn't mean to completely swamp it, because now the new price, let me just do a different one. Make that new D2 down there. So this first one, I'm going to put an X through it. Okay, that new D2 right there, so demand increased also. So see there, so prices, or sorry, the purchasing power of money still goes down, but not as much, because demand increased as well as the supply of money. So that's, so if you're using a supply and demand framework, that has to be what happened. Just in terms of the graphing, if you know the supply went up and the price did not change accordingly, then it must be because the demand partially offset it. So now if you say, okay, well, why would the demand, what changed? What did, something significant happen in the early 1980s to make the demand for U.S. dollars go up? And a lot of supply-side economists, and I think they're right on this, would say, yeah, the Ronald Reagan tax rate reductions. That, if you don't know, I mean, it was fairly drastic. It was, I think it went from, well, I know it went from like 70% down to 28% by the end of the second Reagan administration, but I'm trying to remember what the original, I think it was like from 70% down to 50%, something like that, in terms of the top marginal income tax rate on the top bracket. In a very short time, like phased in over a few years, like 81 and 82, something like that. Okay, so it was a pretty significant, when people talk about the Reagan tax cuts, that's what they're talking about. And yes, it's true, and Murray Rothbard's written on this, that the Reagan administration also raised Social Security taxes. So you can argue on net, was there a tax cut for Americans as a whole? But clearly, in terms of the incentives for high-income people to go out and earn more dollars, or for corporations to report higher earnings, or for people, for foreign investors to get into dollar-denominated assets, the fact that that top rate used to be 70% and then got brought down fairly quickly and substantially, that's a big shift in terms of your after-tax return. And so, so anyway, that's what happened, and I would think that that's a big part of what happened here. So that the international, so remember, it's not just Americans holding dollars. It's also foreigners who now, if they see, if all of a sudden now, oh, the tax rate on U.S. corporations went down, and so I want to now own stock in U.S. corporations. Well, ultimately, how do they do that? They, you say you're a Japanese person, you want to invest in the U.S. stock market. Well, you have to go to the foreign exchange and have your yen buy dollars with which to buy stuff. So that makes the dollar strengthen against the yen. So now imports are cheaper in the United States. And so that means retailers in the United States that are shipping goods from Japan, importing goods from Japan, they can do it more cheaply. So their prices, the cost of their inputs go down. And so they can afford to sell at a lower price than they otherwise would. All right, so that's just one way of seeing the mechanism. But the big picture point is, if there are major policy changes that make people want to get into the dollar, that would change. Another thing is also, in the early 80s, there was a terrible recession, and what people thought happened is Volcker, who was the Fed chair, he wanted to break the back of price inflation, right? So there had been high price inflation in the late 1970s, and it was starting to get out of control in the sense that people started expecting it. And once those price inflationary expectations get built in, it's hard to break out of that cycle. Because now if people think prices are going to rise 10% next year, they want to spend their money now and get rid of it. But that very action pushes up prices. You see how that works? And so Volcker jacked up interest rates, caused a terrible recession in the early 80s, but got price inflation under control. And so it went from having a period of double-digit price increases to only, whatever, 4% a year, something like that. I didn't look at the numbers recently. Don't quote me on the numbers, but it was a significant collapse in price inflation. And so that's another reason that the demand now for dollars went up, is because before people were thinking, oh, why would I want to hold on to dollars because they're going to lose 10% of their value every year, to now thinking, oh, they're only going to lose 4% every year. And so just even those, that change would make you want to hold more dollars than you otherwise would have. Okay, so the point of me going over this is not that I want you to walk away with knowledge of the Reagan administration. The point of me going over this is I want you to see that just because for most of the lecture I've been focusing on, oh, the terminological shift, and since it's the Fed or the European Central Bank or whoever that controls the stock of money, they're the ones responsible for price inflation. Yeah, I still think that's true historically, but my point is don't walk away from that thinking that, oh, it's a very mechanical thing, and if prices went up 3% last year, it's because the quantity of money must have gone up 3%. I'm not saying that. It's ultimately set by supply and demand, but the point is the institution controlling the stockpile of money, that's pretty powerful. And they can increase that. I mean, Ben Bernanke right now can create $1 quadrillion tomorrow if he wants to. And so in that kind of situation, when you look at Zimbabwe or you look at the Weimar Republic in Germany where they had the hyperinflation, that's not because the demand dropped. And you want to understand, how did they get 1,000,000%, 1,000,000,000% rates of annual price increase? It's because they totally cranked up the printing press. It's not just that they were running, humming along smoothly and everything was fine, and then for some reason out of the blue, the demand for their currency dropped 99.9999% in 1 year. That's not what happened. In theory, if that did happen, then yeah, you'd see that kind of price inflation. But in reality, the demand doesn't on its own move like that. All right, next slide, commodity versus fiat money. Let me just skip ahead here and make sure I pace myself. Right. Okay. Okay, commodity versus fiat money. So here, I just want to say that historically, the market created money. But then what happened is states gradually monopolized its production. So historically, so here's what I want you to understand. We now, unless there's somebody really old watching this video, we all, when we think of money, unfortunately, I think most of us think of pieces of paper that our governments have created. And that's, historically, that's not what it was. Money used to be an actual commodity, something that was a good in the marketplace besides its role as being money. So you're probably familiar with gold and silver, but in different societies and different periods in time, other things have been money also. Maybe some of you have heard in POW camps, there's a famous economics article talking about how cigarettes in a World War II POW camp became money. And the prisoners in the camp would actually have a blackboard up and would have prices of things. Like they would get rations from the Red Cross or whatever, and so they would have a certain amount of salted meat, and they would have, I don't know what else they had in those things, but they would sell that stuff, they would trade in it, and they actually had blackboards giving the prices at the moment, price quotes, and saying this is how many cigarettes you would need to give to get an extra ration of meat or whatever it was that they had to buy and sell. And the cigarettes were included in the rations. That's where they were getting the cigarettes from. That was part of each of these care packages for the prisoners had a small number of cigarettes in it. And so those things, because they were very useful as a medium of exchange, they developed and became money. And that was just the way they trade. So even somebody who's a non-smoker would give up something valuable for the right number of cigarettes, not because he wanted to smoke them, but because he knew he could turn around and trade them for something else that he wanted. So once the process started snowballing, it just took off to the point where everybody was trading everything against cigarettes. So historically, the things that marked that economies embraced as the best form of money were the precious metals, gold and silver. And there's a couple, well, more than a couple, there's a few reasons for why that occurred. So there are properties that gold and silver have that make them excellent choices to serve as money. So for one thing, they're durable, and that was a problem with cigarettes, right? That you couldn't, a given cigarette after a while from getting passed hand to hand is going to sort of get worn down. And what you could do is unroll it, because really what they cared about was the tobacco. So if you got a new paper to roll it in, you could open the first one and dump the tobacco in and re-roll it. But at some point, I don't know much about tobacco. I don't know how long that lasts. I'm not a smoker. But I imagine a cigarette 30 years later probably isn't going to taste right as it compared to a new one, is my guess. Whereas a gold coin from 100 years ago is still perfectly fine. And in fact, when pirate ships and stuff sink, and then 200 years later they send submarines down there to get their treasure chest, there could have been gold and silver coins sitting at the bottom of the ocean for 200 years, and they're still fine. That's still salvageable, and that's still gold, and that's still silver, whereas if you had a $100 bill that went to the bottom of the ocean, maybe that wouldn't last, although actually $100 bills are pretty sturdy. So that's one thing with gold and silver. Another is they are fairly homogeneous in their substance, and they're malleable, and so you can, and they're divisible. I'm not kind of using different terms that are, I'm trying to get the same point there. So why would gold and silver become used as money, whereas diamonds and emeralds wouldn't? Because you might think, well, they're all pretty to look at, and diamonds and emeralds are pretty valuable too. So how come people didn't use diamonds as money? Why did they use gold? Well, diamonds aren't interchangeable. If I say, here's a pound of diamonds over here, and here's another pound of diamonds over here, as long as they're both a pound of diamonds, you don't care, right? That's not true at all. What if the thing in my left hand consists of 10 huge diamonds that each weigh a tenth of a pound, whereas over here there's 1,000 little dinky diamonds? You see that those don't have the same market value. Whereas with gold, if we're just talking about hunks of gold, I mean, not ones that have been fashioned into a nice coin or something, but just raw hunks of gold, really all you care about is how much it weighs, because you can just melt it down and put it together. And so a pound of gold is a pound of gold. You know, like, it's, again, assuming you're talking about its raw form. You don't care whether it's in big clumps or little clumps. It's all the same to you. So there's that issue. And then the other thing, too, is it's much easier for someone to inspect gold and silver and to determine, is this really gold and silver? Whereas with a diamond, you really have to know what you're doing to be able to assess, is this thing, you know, how valuable is this thing, right? So you can see there, for various reasons, gold and silver were much more suitable to be embraced as money. And then another consideration is they had a convenient market value by weight. So copper, you might say, well, how come copper didn't become money? Because it wasn't valuable enough. For the types of transactions that people wanted to do, engage in on a day-by-day basis, you would need a lot of copper in order to have a sufficient amount of purchasing power. So copper could be used for small change, which historically it was used, but you wouldn't want to have to go buy a house priced in copper, because it would be ridiculous. Whereas you could go buy a house priced in gold, you wouldn't have to give that much gold in terms of the actual weight. And so if you're doing major transactions, what would happen when all the major countries were on a gold standard is when they would settle up, occasionally one country would ship a bunch of gold across the ocean. And so that's expensive to do. You got to get worried about security. You got to rent the cargo space and everything like that. So the point is, it would be crazy if you had to be shipping copper across the oceans, because you'd have to move so much of it to settle relatively small differences in market value in terms of who owed what to whom. So so what happened is gold was the more expensive thing. And so major purchases would be gold, and then smaller things would be with silver. And so a given person, if he had some gold coins on him and some silver coins on him, that was like having a $100 bill, a $50 bill, a 20, and a 1, or something, and a bunch of 1s or something like that, that he had the different denominations, if you will, in terms of market value. Okay, so those are some of the reasons that gold and silver made such excellent monies historically, and why they were embraced as such. So historically, the states gradually took that over. And so I say, originally, the market produced money. You had private gold miners would go out and find gold, so it wasn't like there was one agency that made the money. Gold came from all over. And then you had mints, private companies, that would take the raw gold and hammer it and fashion it into coins that had recognizable insignias on them and had other defensive measures to make it hard to counterfeit them and stuff like that. And there you go. That's all you need. So the free market can produce money. Governments came in, totally screwed it up, and they gradually monopolized it. And they did it piecemeal. They didn't just come in on day one and say, okay, we're the ones making money now. That's it. They did it piecemeal. And over time got to the point now where money is a fiat money. It's not connected to any real good or service. It's just pieces of paper or electronic claims on the government itself, and that's it. And there's nothing backing up the money. So in that process, historically, there was a period where the government had a monopoly issue on banknotes, so that the government was the only one who was allowed to print up a $100 bill, let's say, in the United States. But if you looked at what the $100 bill said on it, it said the bearer of this is entitled to $100 worth of gold coins presented to the U.S. Treasury or something like that. So historically, the way the government gets everybody to start using these green pieces of paper is that it says we will give you gold or silver in exchange for them. And that's how the public got used to using this stuff. And then once they were weaned off of using gold and silver coins in their everyday transactions, everyone just using the pieces of paper, then boom, FDR drops the hammer in 1933 and ends gold convertibility for the average person and just maintains it for central banks, which was formalized after World War II. And then in 1971, Richard Nixon stops even that and says, okay, at this point, nobody can turn in dollars and get gold. Now dollars is a free-floating thing tied to nothing. And so we know the consequences of what happened at that point. Okay, so what's the danger then of government inflation, by which I mean monetary inflation? Okay, money loses its value in two ways. So the first way, I just mean it quite literally, that prices go way up if the government's printing too much money too quickly, and that causes all sorts of problems that people who, I mean, they're effectively being robbed. And it's amazing to me how many economists refuse to see that. And they see this when they take pot shots at Ron Paul. Ron Paul talks about how much the dollar has lost in purchasing power since the formation of the Fed. And all these economists flip out and talk about how dumb Ron Paul is. And how he, and they say, oh, no, because wages go up too. So really the average worker is no worse off. And he's want to shake these people and say, okay, so you're telling me if I were going to give you a printing press that you could go into your basement and crank out $100 bills whenever you wanted, and you didn't have to work, you could just, if you wanted to buy something, you could just go in your basement and print off the money, you're saying you wouldn't jump at the chance to do that? That you wouldn't have a higher standard of living if I gave you a printing press that could produce legal money? And of course everyone would say, yeah, of course I would take that. I mean, if you didn't have any moral misgivings about it. So you say, all right, so the fact that you're now able to drive Ferraris and you buy a mansion and you eat steak and caviar every day and you go on expensive cruises because you're just cranking on $100 bills in your basement whenever you want to buy something, is society richer because I gave you a printing press? Where's all that stuff coming from? It's getting redistributed from everybody else. It's not that there are more Ferraris in existence because I have a printing press. It means I'm getting Ferraris and other people aren't. Or what it means is resources are now getting channeled into making Ferraris that aren't getting channeled into something else. So by me giving you, the listener here, a printing press, you can enrich yourself, but only by impoverishing everybody else, relatively speaking. So if it's just you and you're only printing $1 million a year in new money, that's, in the grand scheme, that's not going to be a big deal. The other billions of people on Earth aren't going to notice much. It's just, but technically they are slightly poorer. And they have to be because you're richer. But if you start going crazy and printing off $1 billion a year, and so that you're consuming $1 billion worth of goods and services, well, then now we're talking. And the rest of us might actually notice. And so how would that actually manifest itself to us? Well, prices would go up. So it's not that you having a printing press physically sucks a TV out of my house. And I say, oh, my gosh, I had a TV, but now since you have a printing press, now I don't have it anymore. No, the way you enrich yourself and impoverish us is that you're able to go out in the market, and no matter how expensive stuff gets, you can just print up more $100 bills and buy it. So whatever, anything you want, you can go buy because you just print up the money, whatever it costs. Whereas the rest of us, we don't have that luxury. It's true over time, as you keep printing up more and more money, my paycheck is going to go up. And I'm going to be earning eventually $1 million an hour. But I'm not going to be rich, because the reason that's going to happen is that the prices of everything get pushed up too. And we know it has to be, on average, if you're fantastically wealthy, if your standard of living is way higher because you're printing up money, that by itself doesn't mean we're producing more physical stuff. So the only way your standard of living can go up is if the rest of us get poorer. So yeah, over 100 years, if prices go way up because you've been printing money, our wages are going to go up too, but we're certainly poorer by how much you're richer. So when the government has control of the printing press, when you want to understand what's the problem with that, well, one thing is that it literally gives the government an avenue to rob everybody else. That it taxes them a certain amount, it borrows from them, and then the excess, it prints up that which it doesn't want to borrow or tax. If it resorts to just outright inflation and buy stuff with the printing press, now we're not going to get into it because we only got a few minutes left. In modern times, things are really complicated where technically major governments run deficits and then have the central bank print money to sop up that debt. So it's like they inflate and run off the debt at the same time, which is really crazy. But so the two things get mixed together in practice. But in terms of antiquity, I mean, this is what monarchs used to do, or Caesar or whatever. They would take in a bunch of taxes that were, let's say, gold coins. They would melt them down, and then they would add a baser metal, something that wasn't gold, and then they would make new coins. So they could make more coins than they took in originally because they added that base metal. But now each individual coin had a lower gold content. And that's where the term debase the currency comes from, because they were adding in a baser metal to the precious metal, reducing the gold or the silver content of the coin. And why would they do that? Well, because they wanted to spend more. They were a little bit ahead of the curve. They took in 1,000 gold coins, debased it, and made 1,100 coins that didn't have as much gold, and then now they can go out and buy stuff. And now they have 1,100 coins instead of having 1,000 coins. You can get more stuff with 1,100 than you can with 1,000. And it's true, they keep doing that, and over time the prices of things quoted in those coins is going to go up, but still the king or the Caesar, whoever, is gaining from that, that with each new iteration, they come in the marketplace first with that new money. And so they're the ones that start absorbing the goods and then push up prices as a result. Okay, the other way money loses its value is that if the purchasing power sinks too quickly, then it's not a good money. All right, so I didn't stress this before, but one of the reasons gold and silver made for good money is that their stockpile was relatively rigid. So you didn't need to worry about all of a sudden the quantity of gold increasing by a factor of 5 in 1 month. Now, historically, there were things like the California Gold Rush, or when European explorers discovered South America and whatever, and there were massive influxes of gold and silver from colonies back to Europe, and that caused inflation. But compared to what governments can do with the printing press, that was nothing. That was a drop in the bucket compared to the stuff that you see in, for example, interwar Germany or Zimbabwe more recently. And so what I'm saying is, when the government does that, even if it's not as extreme, even if you just have the inflation like the U.S. had in the 1970s, beyond that being problematic in the sense that I talked about a few minutes ago, where, in a sense, the people who are creating that new money are redistributing real goods and services away from the other people who have a lag before their wages go up. Besides that, the issue is just in general, as that gets more and more out of hand, the dollar becomes less tenable as a store of value, as money, and it ceases to function. So part of the role of money is it helps us calculate. It helps us plan the future. If you're a business, you got to figure out, what do I project for my consumer demand? What do I project for the prices of my inputs? And do I want to spend the money now to build a new factory to be able to increase output in the future? For you to make all those projections, you have to calculate in terms of money. And so if the money is depreciating in terms of its purchasing power at a high rate, that's bad. But the thing that's really bad is if it's a high and an unpredictable rate. So that right now, you really don't have any idea what $100 is going to be able to buy in the market 5 years from now. If that's the case, if you really can't plan out more than 5 years, then your economy is in trouble if business people can't project that far. And so it defeats the purpose of having money in the first place if its value is so unpredictable a few years out. So that's another major problem with price inflation. Okay, the last thing I'll talk about here. Instantly, do you guys have any questions? I don't see any in the Q&A thing, but I'm having trouble pulling it up. No, I don't see anything. All right, so I guess I'll just go to the wire here. Last thing is the boom bust cycle. So we're not gonna. You don't need to know this for the course so much, except for whatever remarks I might give you right now. But if you wanted to learn more, we do talk about this stuff. But I'm not covering this topic per se in this course. But what the Austrians say, this is the Austrian business cycle theory. They say that depressions or recessions are caused by an inflationary boom beforehand. So a lot of schools of thought, and especially the typical financial analysis that you'll see in the mainstream media, they're looking at the recession. The economy is humming along nicely. Gee, the economy was fine in 2005, 2006, 2007, and then all of a sudden, boom, the world falls apart in 2008. What the heck? Or back in the 1920s, yeah, we had a fine economy, 26, 27, unemployment was great, the stock market was booming, this was great, 28, okay. And then all of a sudden, in 1929, for some reason, the stock market crashes, and then the Great Depression happens. And from this mainstream typical perspective, they're trying to figure out what went wrong to make the economy sink when the crisis ensued, and then what can we do as policymakers now that we're in this rut to get out of this recession? We want to go back to prosperity as quickly as possible. What do we do to fix the recession? And so the Austrian diagnosis says, no, that's all wrong. The problem is the preceding inflationary boom. So the question with the stock market is not in the 1920s. The question is not how come all of a sudden in 1929 the stock market fell so quickly. The Austrian would back up the tape and look at the market rising like crazy a few years beforehand up until that point and say what pushed the stock market up to such ridiculous levels. It's no wonder that it crashed because it had been pushed up to an unsustainable level. So the question is not how do we keep it up there at this crazy level. The question is what pushed it up and what do we do in the future so that that doesn't happen again. There's a similar thing with the housing bubble and bust. The Austrian, the standard Austrian view is not what went wrong in 2007 or whenever you want to date the turning point that all of a sudden made housing prices start collapsing. The question is, what in the world made housing start rising like crazy? why did it go through the roof for so long? And given that it did and got overpriced, well, it's not surprising that at some point reality set in and it came crashing down. But the way to prevent that, the Austrians say, is to eliminate the preceding inflationary boom. So that's why they call it a boom-bust cycle. They don't just say, why do recessions happen? They say that, no, you got to look at the whole thing. It's this unsustainable boom. And so the Austrians, what causes the unsustainable boom? They say it is artificially low interest rates that are caused by an expansion or an inflation of money and credit. So in addition to all the other problems I talked about, that when the government takes over money and banking and has knocks down the market's normal checks against rapid expansion in the money and credit supply or stockpile, the government beats that down with its central banking and other regulations and so forth, and allows for much more rampant inflation than would happen on a free market. And so in the standard Austrian view, it's that inflation of the money supply and the credit supply on or stockpiles that pushes down interest rates to artificially low levels. It makes businesses start investing more than the real structure of production can support. And so things get out of whack, and it gives this temporary illusion of prosperity. So one way to think about it is, before I talk about what if you just got a printing press, what if everybody got a printing press? That would, for a while, lead to this euphoria. Everybody would feel rich for a little while if we all got printing presses and all thought we could just print them $100 bills and go buy whatever we wanted. And the point is, the subtle Austrian point, is that that illusion of prosperity could actually be real for a little while. In other words, it wouldn't just be in our head, that we really could all increase our consumption. We could all start driving Ferraris and eating out steak dinners and so on, because what would happen is the economy would shift, and instead of producing tractors and drill presses, it would start producing more Ferraris and steak dinners. And that there's some leeway where the economy would effectively be consuming its physical capital because it wouldn't be replacing the capital goods. So it's like, think back to Crusoe. If he just stopped repairing the net and just started using the net like crazy and catching as much fish, or if he stopped repairing the pole and started knocking down as many coconuts as he could with his working hours and didn't pour back some of his time into keeping the pole in good maintenance, his coconut consumption could go up for a while. And so he could be fooled. So it wouldn't just be in his head. No, he really would be eating more coconuts per day than before, but he would be consuming his pole, so to speak, and not realizing it. So that's what the Austrians say happens during the inflationary boom, is people really do have a higher standard of living, but they don't realize they're consuming their capital because the inflation masks that. Because prices are rising, they think they're being responsible. Businesses think, no, I'm putting enough aside to buy, you know, to replenish my inventory once I sell this batch, because they don't realize how much prices are going to be up when they go to replenish their inventory. And so they're going out, issuing dividends, buying mink coats for their wives, thinking, oh, business is booming, this is great, not realizing, no, business is the same as it always was. It's just there's more money now, and that's making your sales go up. And you should really be saving a lot more of that than you are, because your prices are going to go up, your input prices are going to go up more than you think. So everybody collectively makes a mistake, or most people make mistakes, and that's the gist of the Austrian story. Okay, well, we're out of time. I'm going to stop there. Thank you, everyone, for taking the class. I hope you learned a lot, and hopefully you'll be keeping your eye out for other Mises Academy courses, not just from me, but from a whole stable of different lecturers, and encourage you to go to Mises Academy website and check out the new offerings. Because there's also, in case you don't know, there's a summer sale. So I think all the courses that are going to be offered over the summer months are 50% off of what they normally would be. So by all means, go check that stuff out. Okay, thanks, everybody. And if you're taking the course for credit, I will shoot out the quiz, then I'll give you information on the final exam, which will be posted next week.